Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith. Hey everybody, this just in, a new episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm Chad Wesley Smith, joined by the notorious MAX, Max Montana Ada. How you doing today, my good man?
I'm doing pretty well.
Pretty well. Excellent. Well, before we get into things, let's give a quick thank you to the sponsors. Virus International, use Jug for 10% off. Grind Sports Nutrition, very simple but effective supplements designed by the fine minds at Renaissance Periodization. Jug 10 for 10% off. And Trifecta Nutrition. If you want great-tasting food delivered right to your door, trifectanutrition.com/juggernaut, and milligrams and kilograms. The more you take, the more you make. It's a lifestyle, especially for some. Yeah. So today we're going to be answering questions that came to us through Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, all the different places on a variety of topics. So let's just go ahead and get right into it.
Question number one.
All right. What is the benefit of powerlifting hypertrophy cycle if you're isocaloric? So we got this question in a couple different forms on Instagram, asking about, you know, cutting during a hypertrophy cycle or, you know, not actively trying to gain weight during it. So If you're cutting or you're not trying to gain weight, gain muscle actively through that training cycle, hypertrophy, I guess, then would be a bit of a misnomer.
Yeah.
It's sort of a semantics issue at that point. We could call it a general training block. We could call it maybe a work capacity training block. And that's really going to be where the benefit comes in for someone who's in an isocaloric state. So they're trying to maintain their body weight, doing high volume training, you know, sets of 6, 8, 10, maybe even 12 reps, and pushing to increase the volume of work from week to week is still going to be beneficial in the long run because it's going to prepare you to do a greater amount of work. Mm-hmm. So if doing this high-volume training, again, trying to avoid the word hypertrophy, as that would not be the goal anymore for this block, doing the high-volume work during that first block of training can still satisfy the principle of phase potentiation, and that it's going to increase the potential of the subsequent strength block, because now instead of doing, you know, 5 sets of 6 at 75% to 80%, now you can do 6 sets of 6 at 75% to 80%, and, you know, get through the training effectively, and, you know, I don't know if it's going to really have any impact on the recovery abilities, but at least the fitness level you have to do the specific training session will be improved.
Yeah, it would make sense, I guess, if you're not trying to move up a weight class. I mean, you're not going to build any muscle if you're not eating a surplus of calories, or it would be negligible at best. So, I mean, it really doesn't have any place if you're trying to move up a weight class. That would not be. Would not be hypertrophy anymore. You're not going to gain any muscle. If you are trying to move a weight class, not the correct solution. If you aren't trying to move a weight class, then it would have merit in that that phase just changes a little bit. Its end goal is a little bit different than it was as a hypertrophy block.
Yeah, the training isn't necessarily going to look very different.
Yeah, the training would look very similar.
Yeah, it as a whole might need to be lower volume than the training if you were in a hypercaloric state, just because you don't have as much fuel for your training. So getting into the idea of being in a hypocaloric state, something I'm an expert in, weight cutting. And we're going to do a more in-depth, or Dr. Isertel is going to do a more in-depth video on the relationship between phasic structure of training and phasic structure of dieting. But trying to cut, doing that in a high-volume training phase, again, hypertrophy would be a misnomer because you're not going to build muscle when you're in a calorie deficit. But I would still advise people to do high-volume training while trying to to cut weight, because when you do high volume training, you have a greater caloric expenditure. And with that greater caloric expenditure, it means you can eat more and still be in a deficit. So if you're doing low volume training, which just for the sake of example, let's say requires 2,500 calories as your maintenance, and so now you have to eat 2,200 to be in a deficit. But if you're doing high volume training, which requires 3,000 calories instead of 2,500, now you can eat 2,700 and still be in a deficit. So you get to eat more, and which in the long term will give you more flexibility to your dieting, because if the number starts out too low, you know, you do low volume training and you can only eat 2,200 to lose. Well, as time progresses, you're going to have to eat less and less and less to continue to lean out. But if you allow yourself to start at a higher number, you know, you're going to give yourself kind of more room to progress. And again, that's coming from weight cutting expert, lean gains champion,
Slim Wesley Smith.
Slim Wesley Smith. How bloated do I look on this camera right now? It's a fisheye.
Every camera adds lens. 10 pounds, yeah. And there's 32 cameras on him right now.
So, yeah, it does have a benefit, though. It would be a bit of a misnomer, as it's no longer the goal of hypertrophy. Rather, it would be the goal of work capacity or relatively general training to satisfy the principle of variation, avoiding adaptive resistance. Because if all you do is you know, single, it's going to stop having much benefit. Case in point. So throwing in, you know, some higher volume work just really for the sake of variation almost, but, you know, with the goal of avoiding adaptive resistance will be beneficial to you. So this question coming in from...
Question number two.
Coming from Instagram, from Dominic Bai. Said, what current lifters, powerlifters and weightlifters, impress us the most?
I would say Lasha, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but the super heavyweight who snatched 217, incredibly impressive.
It's Lasha Tzuzotlaklub.
Lasha Tzatziki sauce. He's by far the most impressive lifter currently in the realm of, I mean, 217 is the absolute best snatch done ever in competition in weightlifting, and competition is the only place that weightlifting counts or matters.
And I think he's, you know, the weights he's lifting by themselves are incredible.
Yeah.
Then when you factor in the other aspects like his age, he's, you know, pretty young.
22?
Pretty young guy, yeah.
Something like that.
That he's doing it in big competitions.
Yeah.
First the world record at the Olympics, then increasing the world record at European Championships.
Yep.
And then when you look at the guy, he's not the body type you associate with weightlifting.
Looks like a plumber.
Yeah. I mean, besides just having a sort of this regular shaped body.
He's big.
Very big, like 6'7".
Yeah.
But he's not 6'7" with short arms relative to his body. No. Like, when he stands up with the snatch,
it's very, very
strong. Yeah, the bar is like 9 feet in the air. That 100-kilo muscle snatch video.
Yeah, it's very easy. You know, the thing that's really impressive to me about him is that not only is he a very, very, very strong lifter, he's an excellent technician. And it's very easy in that regard to be, you know, Rezazadeh was a very ugly technician. I mean,
he's, person. man's got an ugly body.
Your words, not mine. But, you know, he was not a pretty – he wouldn't say, oh, Rezazadeh is like a model, beautiful technique, really, really nice. You know, Salimi, very same. Like, they're just – it's all about big numbers and be as strong as possible. You know, Lasha looks like he's very, very well trained. He's been brought up in a system that's very productive, very, very concise. You know, his movements are excellent. They're crisp, sharp. All his technique is really, really pretty. So he's, you know – That's impressive to see that, not just some incredibly strong guy, because he's also very, very strong.
Yeah, on the powerlifting side of things, for me, you know, a couple of weeks ago we were at the U.S. Open, and we got to see a lot of people who are definitely impressive, you know, but I came away less impressed by some people than I went in being. Yeah, and everyone's going to have bad meets. I've had bad meets, and injuries happen and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But let's say for Belkin in particular, you know, he's made massive totals and is incredibly impressive. So please don't construe this as me saying that I don't think that he's impressive. But I went in with an image of him in my head as basically mini Milanichev. And I've competed maybe two times in the same meet as Milanichev now and been around him for another two meets. And between those four meets, I believe he has missed three lifts. One deadlift, in which was after the misload Boss of Bosses 2, and he got injured on. Yeah, that I think was extenuating circumstances. A bench at Boss of Bosses, I believe. I only think he missed a bench there, and he was coming off that torn pec like 2 weeks before. And then a bench at Big Dogs, in which I think it was the judge. He missed it on a technicality that I think was the judge's fault. Not that it was a bad call, but they called him for like a heave or sinking the bar after the press command, but that was because they gave him the press command too early. Like, the bar had never stopped when they gave him the press command. So he was just benching to his own sort of tempo, and they forced him basically into it. But the moral of the story here is Milanichev doesn't miss. And I saw Belkin miss a lot of lifts. He's extremely impressive, but I came away less impressed, I guess, than I was expecting to be. If there was a lifter who stands out the most as the most impressive, is Ray Williams.
Oh, yeah. I mean, hands down.
It's just ridiculous.
John Hack was really impressive.
Yeah, the man who beat John Hack, Ben Pollock, also extremely
super impressive. Those guys, that was a great battle.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Ray Williams, by far, is just so far out in the front of that pack. Because there's, for me, it's like, what is the end of this? I mean, the potential, it's not like he, 12 years into his career, 15 years in, he eked out that 1,052. It's like, oh, he's just getting started, and he's, a mile ahead of everybody else.
Yeah, he's measuring improvement by the tens of kilos, not by the half kilo chip. Yeah, Milanichev, as I was mentioning, the man doesn't miss. He goes anywhere and makes the biggest totals in the world. I think Ray Williams, with the circumstance of IPF and everything that comes with that, is just amazing. Is great across all the lifts. Personally bias, obviously, but I think I take it for granted sometimes being around her so much that Marissa is amazing.
Yeah, super impressive.
That people forget, if you've seen the videos of me spotting Marissa in the squat, that should give you a better perspective on how small she actually is. She's a very tiny person.
Mm-hmm.
But because I've seen her lifting for a long time and expect her to make these big lifts, I think I take it for granted at times that this is just a tiny, tiny woman pulling 400-plus-pound deadlifts and benching over 200 pounds and squatting well into the 300s, doing it at 40-plus years of age, doing it as a mother of two kids, doing it with an incredible physique, being lean, doing it across all three lifts where it's not just this freakish anomaly in one lift that pushes the total over the top. In a similar way to 2011, 12, 13, where Dan Green was just setting the world on fire when he was breaking all these total world records without having any single lift world records.
Yeah.
That to me is makes someone a bit even a greater powerlifter.
Yeah.
That they are the best at the sport of powerlifting, the total, without being the best at any of the single lifts. So meaning they have to be great at all of them and doing it with a near stage ready physique.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true.
And then doing that in the USAPL IPF versus the not pushes it even to another level.
Yeah, the milligrams and kilograms lifestyle.
Yeah. And there's so many out there and that I'm sure we're forgetting. You see the training videos of
it's impossible to say.
Chinese guys, Tian Tao's training videos where he's squatting 300 for a triple or something.
Yeah, something ridiculous.
Just insane.
But, it's like, and I think that's a huge thing to remember is like, that's awesome. He does it in training, but it just doesn't mean shit. It's not. I mean, there's a million, how many guys on Instagram are there out there doing big lifts? They don't ever go to meets. It's like, you're not a weightlifter. You're just a guy working out. Like, That's awesome. It's impressive and strong, but it's not weightlifting. It's not powerlifting. To do it at meet, it doesn't mean anything.
When if the question was who's the most impressive strong guy, it changes the context of it.
Thor Bjornsson.
and those guys are just a whole nother deal. But when the question is who's the best powerlifter, who is the best weightlifter, who is the most impressive, and that you can only quantify that by meet performance because that is the sport of powerlifting. That is the sport of weightlifting. It is not the training. It is the one day when it matters, when three judges sit in the chair and say, yes, that was good. No, that wasn't good.
Yep.
Thank you to Virus International, sponsor of the Jug Life podcast. Visit virusintl.com and use Jug, J-U-G-G, for 10% off your next order. Numero Trace. Angelia Hayes asks, what are your recommendations for training immediately following a powerlifting meet? So we'll talk powerlifting and weightlifting here. And so much, you know, so much of what we and everyone else talk about is how do you get ready for the meet? But then the post-meet time gets into this sort of murky, mystery type of time. And the first thing that has to be considered after the competition is, are you healthy? You know, if you sustain some sort of injury during the competition, even if stuff just hurts a lot and maybe not quite into the realm of injury, that's going to change the context of all of this, and this would be a different discussion. So let's just say you're have the regular soreness and fatigue generated from a meet, but no extenuating circumstances, no injury on top of it. Where the trick and the tough part of this kind of happens is if we take an athlete who has a peaking phase of training plus a taper plus a competition plus maybe a very light week of training after, and then try and jump them right back into high volume hypertrophy general work capacity type of training, they're going to be really, really bad at it. Particularly the more advanced athlete, let's say myself in powerlifting, where I have a 2-month long peaking block, 2 months of training in the 1, 2, and 3 rep range with lower frequency throughout the week, 4 training sessions for me instead of 5 that I do during hypertrophy or strength, and then a 2-week taper, and then doing the meet, I could be looking at 9 weeks of very little training volume. So it would be unrealistic to think to go from 9 weeks of singles, doubles, and triples that I'm going to do very well jumping right back into tens.
Yeah. I think something to note is that qualification, size, gender play, in my opinion, play the biggest role in this portion of planning, because just like Chad said, 9 weeks of essentially very low training volume, mostly singles and doubles and maybe triples, with large periods of no training, rest days, probably more rest days or more very, very light training days, technical workouts. For a person who's at the highest level of qualification, largest body weight class, male, you have all these factors going in. The training has to be planned well so that same for weightlifting and powerlifting, but that you're accounting for all of that and you're accounting for the subsequent, I don't know what you would call the phase, like a reactivation, but essentially an interim transitional block where they go from very, very low training volume to a very moderate or moderate training volume that's preparing them for an actual, full-on hypertrophy block.
And this goes in either direction, whether moving from hypertrophy to strength, strength to peaking, mm-hmm. and then coming back from moving peaking back into hypertrophy. Transitions between training blocks need to be smooth.
Yes.
Very abrupt changes in training are going to be more likely leading to injury. So that needs to be taken into account. So it's basically the length of this phase is going to be determined by size, strength, gender, proximity to career peak. Immediately following the competition, doing some training is a lot better than just hanging out for a week. doing very low structural stress training just to promote blood flow in the muscle is going to improve recovery. So, you know, maybe you don't squat at all that week, but you go in and leg press and you know, do all machine-based workouts. It's totally fine because that's going to be a lower neural stress. It's going to be easier on the body, but it's going to achieve the goal of blood flow into the muscle, which is going to promote recovery. So for someone who's very, very advanced, that could be 2-3 weeks like that. For someone who is just finishing their first meet and has been training for under a year, that might be, you know, they compete on Saturday, and they could probably go do that on Sunday, Monday, and start training regularly again on Tuesday. Just from a practicality standpoint, it's probably going to be at least a week of that. It might be the first couple days with just the machines, and then the second half of the week, this sort of ramp-up phase, which will be the next thing I mention. And I've started to implement this a lot more with my more advanced lifters, Brandon Allens, Andy Huang, Steve Gentile type of guys, is we can't just jump back into, you know, we can't go peaking, taper, meet, easy week, 5 sets of 10 the next week. So what we'll do to ramp up into that, let's say our goal the first week of regular hypertrophy is to do 5 sets of 10 the squat, 65% to 70% intensity. So the first week of this reacclimation time would be maybe 5 sets of 6 at 65% to 70% intensity. Then the second week, 5 sets of 8 at 65% to 70% intensity. And then finally, the third week, being able to get back into the regular training. Now, this will be a bit different strategy for weightlifting because, you know, the technical qualities and stuff need to be, you need to stay in touch with that more frequently. So how would you change that?
A lot of it is going to look like the opposite of the way you went into the meet. So the first week after training, there's going to be, you know, very, very low volume of training. You're still able to start incorporating more of the general exercises because, you know, again, squats and pulls and presses and whatnot and bodybuilding exercises are general in nature, and they're not going to be as specific. So you don't – it's not taxing as much. But you're very much like Chad. You're going to kind of go in after the competition. There's this phase that looks kind of similar to the way you entered the competition. Low volume, building in volume again, and then increasing intensity as you go back into another you know, general phase where everything is kind of pushing a little harder. It's a little different in weightlifting because the weights are smaller, the movement's faster, technique is a little more tactile thing. You need to kind of stay in touch with, like Chad said. And a lot of times as a coach, you're put in a place where lifters have to compete frequently. You might have a meet in 3 or 4 weeks or 5 weeks or 10 weeks, and you don't have the luxury of a 16-week training cycle going into it. So, you know, you have to be creative about that solution. That kind of comes in play before the competition you just entered. So you set yourself up, you know, with the right kind of training block leading into the competition, not straying too far from some of the general qualities that are necessary without so you're not losing some of those qualities as you transition out of that if the meet's not important. Example would be like Colin Burns going to the Arnold, then going to the AO. His training into the Arnold was very, very similar. That meet, there wasn't a lot of there wasn't a huge deload. There wasn't a large taper. Not really much of a peaking effect took place there because we had a meet, you know, 2 weeks later, in which case we transitioned from that being basically the beginning of his peaking phase that Arnold was, then a couple weeks of you know, much more high intensity, much lower volume training going into the American Open, and he performed well at both meets. And then from there, transitioned back into that sort of reacclimation phase and then into the general training phase where he's going into now, into nationals.
I think it's also important with yourself or with the athletes that you coach to establish an expectation of what the time post-competition is.
Yeah.
Because if the lifter's expectation becomes, I compete and then I take, you know, 2 weeks off, particularly for weightlifters who are going to be generally less muscular than a similarly qualified powerlifter, especially for female lifters, especially for lower weight class male lifters, the detraining effect will be very, very significant there. So the expectation has to be established that we train with purpose all the time. That the training immediately after competition, unless it's, you know, like the end of a quad or the end of a annual plan, it's purposeful training has to be done the week after to prepare you for what is to come, to maximize the long-term result.
Yeah. I think deloads are really important to monitor when you watch your athletes and see the individual responses to changes in load. If you don't have a good handle on how people respond to reductions in load, it's hard to gauge this exact thing. What do we do after meets? How fast do they turn around from these things? So, you know, it's important. Deloads aren't just simply get rid of the volume and let them rest. It's not ever what it's about. It's a very specific targeted training effect you're looking for.
Grind Sports Nutrition is the official supplement provider of Team Juggernaut. Designed by Renaissance Periodization, there are no-nonsense supplements to fuel your hardest training. Use JUG10 at grindsupplements.com. Next question comes to us from Alec Lang on YouTube. Do you implement any kind of isometric training in your athletes' powerlifting or weightlifting programs? So isometric training is something that I have a little bit of experience with, and early in my powerlifting career was something that when I was being coached by Josh Bryant, he implemented during a peaking phase just for the I think I did it for sure for the deadlift and possibly a little bit for the bench press. Isometric in the squat is probably going to be a no-go just from a spinal compression standpoint. Yeah. But in the deadlift, where I remember using it more significantly, is we would do pull in a 6-second pull into a pin. Yeah, I'd put like 405 on, so maybe that was about 50, 55%. And we'd have two different versions of this. I'd just break the floor to a very low sticking point and pull it into the pins and pull as hard as I could against the pins with 405 for 6 seconds. I'd do three sets like that, and then three sets at a high sticking point, maybe about 2 inches short of lockout. So we're working from 2 inches off the floor to 2 inches shy of lockout. And I'd pull as hard as I could, and like the high one was a little weird because you'd smash it into the pins with a light weight like that, and it would almost, you know, jar out of your hand a little bit. But then I would pull constant tension into those pins for 6 seconds at that. But very, very low volume of this, like three sets at the low, three sets at the high. So, you know, 18, 36 seconds of exposure to this for maybe 1 or 2 weeks in the training plan. And that's the important thing, I think, to remember with isometrics, though this holds true for a lot of different training effects that are a lot of different training modalities, is that they're beneficial, but their window of benefit is very small. Mm. The isometric training is hugely stressful to the nervous system, and I think it should be treated in the same type of way that like a shock training, depth jumps, altitude landing type of stuff would be treated. That, yes, it provides a profound training effect, but if it's so easy to overuse and to drive yourself into, you know, high levels of neural fatigue, as we've talked about many times before, the neural SRA curve is very long. So even though the muscular damage being created in isometric training is pretty limited, because one, it doesn't really have much if any eccentric loading where the greatest muscular damage occurs, there's a very small range of motion associated with it. So you're not doing a lot of work. So quantifying the volume of it is a bit tough that way, but it does have a very huge effect on the system. So if it's something that you want to include, go ahead and do that, but use less than you think that you need to use. Mm. You know, it's something I'd say at most 3 to 8 or 10 sets. And these are like single efforts like this 6-second pull for one training block, you know, 3 to 4 weeks out of an entire training cycle. So 3 to 4 weeks out of a 16 to maybe 20, 24 week time period, I think would be sufficient. Do you think there's really any application in weightlifting?
So isometrics, exactly what you're describing, there is basically no application. I guess you would call it isotonic, where you're moving, but you're not pulling against, like in Chad's case in the deadlift, he's pulling against an immovable object, and he's pulling as hard as physically possible. In weightlifting, you see a lot of like snatch with a pause at the knee. That's not truly an isometric in the sense that you're pulling against the bar, continuing against an object that's not moving. And so those kinds of isotonic exercises are play a huge role in weightlifting in terms of developing technical skills, a lot for beginners and just learning the positions and practicing, but really not considered an actual isometric or traditional isometric training. So it doesn't really play any role in weightlifting that I've seen pretty much anywhere. They did used to do it long, long time ago, but it's really lost fashion now. It's not really done anymore.
Would a jerk hold?
Front rack hold? Like, there's like those kind of things where it's a front rack hold and those things, but I think, again, it's not necessarily isometric in that you're just supporting the load rather than pushing against the load, an immovable object. And I think that would be what you'd call isotonic. That's probably incorrect.
What about a contraption where one person's holding a rope and the rope is attached to an elaborate pulley system to the bar, and you pull on as hard as you can, then I let go of the rope and you just finish pulling?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or like if you put a bar in water and you lift it out of the water and you get a photograph of it.
Well, magnets.
Magnets, electromagnets.
Magnets being underutilized.
Lava. Lava, too, is a good.
When who's the Magneto?
Magneto.
Yeah.
He'd probably be a good weightlifter.
All right. And our final question for
number five
today. Should powerlifters, and we'll include weightlifters in this as well, and this question comes to us from Tyler Overton on YouTube. Should powerlifters and weightlifters include explosive movements like sprints, jumps, and throws in their training, and what block would they be included in? So this stuff was certainly a big part of my athletic background and a big part of my early powerlifting career. I came from a track and field background, was a shot putter, a fairly accomplished one, and had done tons of sprints, jumps, and throws in my life. And I think that those created a great foundation for my success in powerlifting. Even early in my powerlifting career, I would still push for very high box jumps, doing a 50-inch seated box jump when I weighed about 290, a 45-inch seated box jump while wearing a 30-pound vest when I weighed 307. The throws and sprints weren't something that I really included then. I know Dennis Cornelius likes to sprint. He does that every week. In my opinion, it's not worth the injury risk. Yeah. There's just too much chance for soft tissue injury, pulled hamstring, pulled quad, something like that, in sprinting like that. But the jumping would have more application, and the same for weightlifting, more application there. But the timing of it and the strategy of the loading is very important. If it's something that you've never done before, if it's never been included in your training, you're going to have to be very purposeful and mindful to have a accumulation block for it. Actually, Kristen Dunsmore, who we coach here for powerlifting, is very slow squatter, very strong, but very slow. And in the sort of general training phase we're in, she asked to include jumping in her training because she wanted to try and get faster. So I came up with a accumulation block of jumping for her where it was at constant box height. And box jump is a great option for a strength athlete because it reduces the force of gravity in the landing. So you're jumping up and maybe only falling, 2 or 3 inches onto the top of the box rather than jumping over a barrier like a hurdle and falling, the whole length of the hurdle back to the ground. So with joint health in mind, that would be a good option. So the way that we did that was constant box height and a medium, high, low structure to the week, where on Mondays she was doing a medium volume of jumping, on Wednesdays a high volume of jumping, on Fridays a low volume of jumping. So maybe four sets of three, six sets of three, or sorry, six sets of three, eight sets of three, four sets of three. And then the next week, four sets of four, or six sets of four, eight sets of four, four sets of four, six sets of five, eight sets of five, four sets of five. So waving it like that to build in some fatigue management, but always at a constant height, just accumulating proficiency in the movement, learning how to land properly, and preparing the body for more intense work. So if you want to introduce it to your training, that's how I would go about doing that. once you've accumulated some volume and some fitness in that, then it's going to be easier to keep it in your training throughout and to manipulate it in different ways for potential training benefit. As I mentioned before, when talking about isometrics, they are comparable to things like shock training, depth jumps, which have a huge, profound effect on strength. East German athletes, power athletes and weightlifters, shot putters and weightlifters, were using that for strength training, but also hugely taxing to the joints, to connective tissues, to the nervous system. If you're going to have a 250-pound powerlifter try and drop off of a 3-foot box and absorb all that force and then redirect it back into another jump, you'd have to really be well prepared for it. So the accumulation part of the training you'd want to put far away, probably even outside of a hypertrophy block per se, into just a general like transitional block, preparatory block, because trying to squat and deadlift for sets of 6, 8, and 10 while also doing a high volume of jumping, they just don't complement each other very well. So you accumulate and then kind of maintain those speed qualities while reflecting, where the jumps can reflect the volume of the lifting. What about jumping for weightlifters?
Very similar. I mean, in weightlifting, the nature of the movements is already more similar to jumping. Obviously, early in someone's career, those things play a huge role, especially for powerlifting, any athlete, the general aspect of...
Even the video we saw today, Sheko.
Yeah, the little kid. He had a little kid doing depth jumps.
The jump part was debatable.
Jump. he was hitting the ground. He was like slippers on, too. It's a very Russian video. But that plays a huge role in the developmental period for athletes. For weightlifting, similar, the jumps, again, looking at the biggest thing is not just giving all weightlifters should do jumping early in the general phases, because a lot of people coming into it are not conditioned to it. It has to be done very, very slowly and with an appropriate accumulation early in the training cycle. The jumps for weightlifters will stay in there, generally through the halfway point through the training cycle as they get closer to peaking, and then they'll start to taper off because you don't want to be competing for the resources for the actual heavy lifts. They can do a good job of maintaining some of the speed qualities while the lifters are essentially on these lighter rest days in the later phases of training as they get closer to competition, so you don't have to do as much snatch and clean and jerk. You might be doing some jumping in there to sort of give yourself more recovery without actually fatiguing yourself further with the lifts.
Now, Colin and Pomp both are very, very impressive,
incredibly
jumpers. At the training center, I remember watching Colin do jumps onto those big wooden jerk blocks and multiple box jumps onto those very casually, like in the high 40s, low 50-inch ranges for sets. Pomp doing like hurdle hops, 42-inch hurdle hops, double leg bounds over those for 5-6 reps at a time. He did a 38.5-inch vertical.
Yeah, they both have near 40-inch verticals for sure.
And then we've got Townsend.
Townsend can fly.
Yeah, he's a different that's thing when it comes to jumping.
Yeah, I don't know actually with James. He's so explosive, it's not even necessary. I mean, it's just such a – it's like an underlying genetic ability that – I mean, he's walked up and did a 43-inch vertical.
Yeah, the jumping is more for show than for,
for anything else. It's for likes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The throws, could have also similar like general physical prep applications. I think a good one, if you do have a very general phase of training, this would fit in well with a like quadrennial planning for weightlifting, is improving general work capacity by increasing volume of throwing in a way that I've found to do that with athletes of different sports, even throwers, is have a relatively heavy med ball, which is going to be dependent on athlete size and their strength, and go out on the field and throw, whatever variety, backwards throw and then walk or jog to the ball.
Yeah.
Then another throw, walk or jog to the ball. Do that for a set amount of time, 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 14, 16. to increase volume through increased time, or to increase density of work. How many throws can they do in X amount of time, or to try and do, you know, more. Yeah, those are the two.
Yeah, no, I mean, those are actually two things I would probably be inclined to incorporate in the training of weightlifters. I mean, in general, I probably haven't in most cases, because there's, you know, usually some kind of time management or just, you know, whatever constraints of the actual yearly calendar.
Yeah, the but qualifying process for American weightlifters, in some ways, I think, does a disservice to the long-term training. Yes. Plans for them, because, you know, they have to lift now. They have to make big lifts now to get the performance stipends, to get on the various teams, to receive the benefits of their performance. It's hard to say. It's hard for someone to be in a position to kind of take that first year of the quad and do the type of training that may set them up for greater success in the fourth year of the quad when it's most important. Because they can't be quite as general in nature.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't step far enough back from it to develop a new foundation. I mean, to be fair, actually, Kendrick Ferris competes very infrequently, and he's been the most successful, most accomplished lifter in the country.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we just saw a video of him doing like 250 for 10 back squats, so clearly he's probably not going to be at nationals. and that process has probably allowed him to continue to develop tremendous general physical qualities, even up to this point, being a three-time Olympian. He's still setting PRs in these general exercise, general kind of workouts. You know, 10 rep max squat is pretty far removed from platform, you know?
Yeah, where these lifters from other countries who have, you know, a bit more established national team practices and maybe international team qualifying that's not as much based on immediate in the immediate what how much can they lift how much did they lift at this meet, where we have five, you know, or AO1 nationals to qualify for at universities, on top of that for people of the right age to qualify for Pan Ams, and then nationals, Pan Ams, AO2, AO3 to qualify for worlds. There's so many opportunities, it forces the athlete to compete maybe too often, so they can't take that step back and lay the huge general foundation of the training, where you see Ilya Ilyin, you know, RIP, taking that whole year away from training after the Olympics to do very general training.
I will say, I mean, that even kind of goes back to their question of time off after meets and this, but like, without a doubt, there's a big benefit to this, and I think it's not easily seen by people, because they're so fixated on what's up front is what is my best snatch and clean and jerk, and even worse, what is my best snatch and clean and jerk today? Getting removed from that and reestablishing the foundation and development of the actual, you know, development of the athlete and monitoring of the process, you know, and establishing the training cycle being a much longer time frame is going to be far more beneficial for athletes. You can even see it in the short training cycles, where there's some time between the competition and the start of the general phase. The lifters generally perform better at the end of those training cycles than they do when they're, you know, 16 weeks versus 12 weeks. And those first 4 weeks are maybe very general in nature, like we're talking about.
And we talk all the time about phasic structure to training, and, you know, most of that time we are referring to a single training cycle. But phasic structure to training applies in the short, medium, and long term. I have an article series, it's probably 3 years old now, called Consolidation of Stressors that addresses this. So we have consolidation of stressors in the short term, a single training cycle, the medium term, the annual plan, and the long term, the athlete's entire training career. Now, that medium term could also be applied to the quadrennial training plan, but really spreading it out to apply the principle of phase potentiation, not just to, all right, I did sets of 8 and 10 in the squat to increase my general strength, which I'll realize, you know, 8 to 12 weeks later at a meet in a peaking phase, but, you know, this year, 2017, I did gymnastics and swimming and medicine ball throws and jumping and all this stuff to increase my potential result in 2020.
Yeah.
And
that's a hard, it's a hard thing to grasp, because a lot of times people, they're put in a position where it's like the sort of culture here too, the dog eat dog sort of, everybody's in the mix and just the best man win. It doesn't really allow for the best possible results at the end. And I think that, you know, a much longer discussion, but it definitely stifles, I think, the potential for results we have.
Yeah. And the lifters who have been able to buy into this idea in the shorter term, you know, like Colin and Courtney and stuff, who aren't concerned with, you know, seeing a lifter make whatever weight on Instagram at 8 weeks out or 10 weeks out and get worried that, oh, I'm behind them right now, because we understand, well, if this person's, you know, maxing out all the time, how is their result going to change 8 weeks or 10 weeks down the road? There's no predictability to that. It may be improved because they had a good day. It may not be because they didn't. But when they understand, okay, the reason I'm doing, you know, like Colin did 65 at the end of the high volume of the hypertrophy or general training, even though his best result is 75, in a less experienced, a less mature, a less disciplined athlete, that may cause panic.
Yeah.
And they may think, I'm 10 kilos away from my best, where in reality, it's I'm 5 kilos ahead of where I was in this training cycle last time.
Yeah.
Because I know I can't, or you know, won't be able to lift 75 right now because of higher fatigue levels, because of lower speed qualities. But it's not when they need the best speed qualities.
That's, you know, that's a big, I don't want to say shout out, whatever, especially to Courtney, is to be embrace that process. You know, the idea that what you do right now is not as important, in, like what your results are right now is not as important as what you're doing, because what you're doing is going to produce results when it matters. And you know, you can see it. It happens at the, you know, there's a reason that two of them both have American records and have improved their American records from before we started this process.
Yeah.
So
Trifecta provides pre-cooked organic food delivered right to your door weekly to help fit with your Renaissance diet, fuel your hard training, improve your recovery, and make your life easier. Visit trifectanutrition.com/juggernaut. So hopefully some very good discussion for you all in there. Some, I think, very insightful answers. So good work there.
Boom.
Yeah.
That's a very good high five.
Yeah. This week we will be in Chicago, Illinois, for USAW Nationals. The whole gang's going to be there. So if you're in the area,
gang goes to Nationals.
If you're in the area, please come by the Westin Lombard. USAW Nationals, support the sport of weightlifting in America. There is going to be great lifting. Mm-hmm. Team Juggernaut men's and women's team battling for the team championship. Our first national, first chance at a national championship. The women already having the American Open title and American Open Series title. They win all the American Opens.
Well, they're the best women's team. They're my favorite women's team.
So come by, check that out, say hi, take a picture, whatever it is you want to do. If you like the podcast, go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review, write us a review. We always like reading those, just the genuine ones that say we're doing a great job, or the funny ones. If you didn't like it, please don't bother writing a review. It's just go on and do something else. Max, where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram, Max Ada. You can find me on Facebook by the same name. You can email max@jtsstrength. Any questions or comments or anything you have about the Juggernaut online coaching, or you can go to juggernautcoaching.com for any more information there.
Make sure you do visit juggernautcoaching.com, because we have new programs both for Masters Weightlifting just released and Super Total Training, the combination of powerlifting and weightlifting. So make sure you go check those out. Thank you for subscribing to our YouTube. We are very proud of the content that we have on here. If you want to find all of the Jug Life episodes, plus merchandise for some of our great sponsors like Pints and PRs, Pop-Tarts and Power Cleans, visit thejuglife.com. I'm Chad Wesley Smith, at Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram. Filling up your newsfeed all day. See you next week.